Good morning, everyone. You are very welcome to St. Stephen's Green Unitarian Church. Welcome to everyone who is watching and listening on our webcam, and welcome to you if you are listening to us on our recordings page on the website. Happy Father's Day, and happy Grandfather's Day. Happy Bloom's Day, and happy birthday to this, our spiritual house. But we have one more thing to celebrate, and more about that later on. My name is Gavin Byrne, and I'm a member of this congregation, and we have a tradition of an open pulpit where members of the congregation are given the opportunity to lead a service. And today you're going to have two for one, two suits. I'm going to lead the service while Rory Delaney will give the address. Our opening words will put into context today's service. This is our anniversary service, celebrating 161 years here in St. Stephen's Green. But of course, the history of this Unitarian congregation goes back centuries. Today, we are Unitarian, but our ancestors were identified by many names, a kaleidoscope of names. These include Puritan, Nonconformist, Presbyterian, Non-Subscribing Presbyterian, New Light Presbyterian, Protestant Dissenter, Unitarian. This church was built by the Strand Street congregation in 1863, but our history, of course, goes back 400 years. What unites us in spirit throughout the centuries were the ideas that we would not quarrel with. It was John Abernathy, minister of the Wood Street congregation, who said in the 1730s that we value friendship and human affections, which will direct the soul towards the love of God. And this, he suggested, was as important as revelation that is revealed in Scripture. The Polish Brethren, the first Unitarian organization in Europe in the 1540s, said it means we are a thinking and tolerant community where we can freely test theological ideas against human experience and reason. One of the more famous of the Brethren, Socini, said it beautiful. He asserted that we are not saved by Jesus dying on the cross. Rather, salvation comes from living in loving relationships with each other. And today we assert that love is the doctrine of this church. Let us read these words together. They can be found on the back cover of your hymn book. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest for truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge in freedom, to serve mankind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow in harmony with the divine, this do we covenant with each other and with God. We now light our chalice, which is lit everywhere Unitarians gather in prayer, celebration, searching, and love. This sacred space, which is gifted to us, is now alive with the friendship, song, poetry, and wisdom of many souls. May we be reminded here of our highest aspirations, and be inspired to bring our gifts of love and service to the altar of humanity. May we know once again that we are not isolated beings, but connected in mystery and miracle to the universe, to this community, and to each other. And our first hymn this morning is number 44, We Sing of Golden Mornings.
Thank you.
And our first reading this morning will now be read by Andrew.
Morning, everyone. There's two parts to my reading. A few weeks ago, I got a text from somebody, a friend of mine, to say, "Oh, you've just been mentioned on the Joe Duffy show." And I was like, "What?" So I went on to Playback to listen to it. And it was a discussion about what the Pope, unfortunately, recently said in relation to gay men joining the priesthood and being in the seminaries. And there was a debate going on where parents, it was mainly parents phoning in and talking about their gay children and how they felt excluded from church and excluded from getting married in church. And so the debate was going on, and right at the end, and I had to listen to the whole thing before I got to Bridget calling in. And in her lovely, gentle, and kind way, she rang in and she spoke about the church and how we've been having same-sex marriages and blessings and civil partnerships here for years. And one thing that really struck me was the way she said, "And it's a privilege, Joe." And it really hit into my heart when she said that. It was so touching. And I don't think he was really listening, because he started then talking about the Blessed Sacrament Chapel or something. I was feeling quite cross about the whole thing, and I was going to do a reading today that had a little bit of that crossness in it, but I decided that I wouldn't go there, but I was going to read just a little bit of it, and then I've got a beautiful poem by Rumi that talks about love, which is what it's really all about. So I'll do the angry bit first. And this is by a guy who has the great name of Ario Mezzolani, and I found him on the internet. So sorry to use that word, a word that was thrown at me plenty of times in the playground and at school. And he says, there's too much faggotry. The Pope's words sparked controversy and reawakened gay pride that seemed dormant under the blanket of eternal debates on human diversity and inclusive language. 2024, a climate collapse, an ongoing genocide, and a general escalation of internal geopolitical tensions demand this commitment of all significant institutions, including the Vatican, which has often been seen as a hopeful intermediary in urgent matters of our time. But as we know, senile delirium spares no one. But I'm not sure I'd let the Pope away with that, really. Not even the Pope. On May 20th, the Pope felt compelled to express his concern about the rampant, quoting verbatim, queerness within seminaries. It might seem like a trivial matter, a slip of the tongue, but how? The Pope of Change, the Reformer, the Who Am I to Judge Pope, comes out with such a blunder. Yes, folks, it happened. The incredible part is not his words, but the journalistic simplification the media made of them. Some spoke of intensification, harsh attitude, words synonymous with a more conservative shift. None of that. What the Pope said is vulgar and offensive. The members of the LGBTQ+ communities around the world understood this very well. A growing sensitivity towards respecting human diversity is something we take for granted in this plural and free millennium. But it hides decades of struggles by homosexuals, bisexuals, trans, and queer activists. In particular, a battle we celebrate every year in June, and will continue to celebrate this year, what we call Pride. And I love this is from Rumi. A moment of happiness. A moment of happiness. You and I sitting on the veranda, apparently two, but one in soul, you and I. We feel the flowing water of life here, you and I. with the garden's beauty and the birds singing. The stars will be watching us, and we will show them what it is to be the thin crescent moon. You and I, unselfed, will be together, indifferent to the idle speculation. You and I, the parrots of heaven, will be crushing sugar, and we laugh together, you and I, in one form upon this earth, and in another form in the timeless sweet land. Thanks.
Thank you, Andrew. So, to our children and young people's story, we've got one. We've got lots of children then behind you. Grant, you can stay here. Come on, okay. So, what sound does a frog make?
Like a ribbit.
Yeah. And then a bee. Bzzz. Okay, ribbit and bzzz. So feel free to join in if you wish. Sorry for the feedback here. Is that okay? So this story is called The Monk and the Fly. Once upon a time, a monk decided to meditate under his favorite tree close to his monastery. The sun was shining, it was warm and very peaceful outside. So he chose his favorite cushion and then he took his umbrella to keep the midday sun off his face. And then when he found his tree, he put down his cushion and was about to sit down and start his quiet meditation when a frog jumped onto his cushion and got comfortable. He looked up at the monk with a big satisfied smile and went, "Ribbit, ribbit, ribbit." Now the monk got a little bit annoyed. He was really looking forward to his quiet meditation on his favorite cushion under his favorite tree on this gorgeous sunny day. And the frog went, "Ribbit, ribbit," and continued to smile at the monk. Now, the monk was a peaceful man, and he asked the frog nicely to move off his favorite cushion under his favorite tree so he could get on with his meditation. But the frog didn't move. "Ribbit, ribbit." Now, he tried sitting down, thinking the frog would just jump out of the way, but the monk didn't want to hurt the frog, obviously. The frog let out another satisfied "ribbit, ribbit," letting the monk know, "I'm staying," almost daring the monk to push him away. So the monk got more and more frustrated. Then he got angry and he got his umbrella and he whacked it down at the frog, quickly jumped out of the way in time. So the monk looked around, worried that someone might have seen him. But there was no one around, and delighted with himself, absolutely delighted, he sat down on his cushion, crossed his legs, closed his eyes, perfect peace. Then about a minute later, a fly started buzzing around him. Bzz, bzz, bzz. It landed on his face, and very gently, the monk moved his hand and the fly buzzed away. The monk went and continued to enjoy his quiet meditation. Now, no sooner had he closed his eyes when bzz, bzz, bzz started again. He could hear the fly coming back again, flying past his ear and landing on his bald head. This time, with a little bit more force, he brought his hand up to his head and the fly buzzed away. But this kept happening. The fly just wouldn't let him be. He kept buzzing around his face, landing, flying off, landing again, and the monk ended up slapping his face and his head to try to keep the fly from bothering him. Bzz, bzz, bzz. So he stood up, and he decided to chase the fly. Took his umbrella. He kept missing him. The fly kept buzzing, buzzing. The monk ran back to his room. He got a big book, flung it at the fly, but of course he missed. The fly kept buzzing, buzzing, buzzing around his head. He ran back to his room, got his big chair and flung that at the fly. But the fly kept buzzing and buzzing around his head. Bzz, bzz, bzz. He was getting totally frustrated at this stage and kept chasing the fly to make it go away and leave him alone. When out of the corner of the eye, he spotted the frog. Ribbit,
Ribbit? The monk nearly exploded with anger. Not the bloody frog again. And the frog let out his long tongue, caught the fly, a delicious snack. And with that, the monk's peace was restored. And he could get back to his favorite tree and start his meditation. But first, he went over to the frog, picked him up, gave him a gentle hug, and put him sitting on his favorite cushion under his favorite tree. The monk then sat on the ground beside the frog, and he had the best meditation ever. Amen. Thank you.
The monk and the fly, or the Unitarian minister and the fly, maybe. So let's sing together hymn number 16, Simple Gifts. Thank you, Josh. Our second reading is entitled, I Am a Unitarian, by the Reverend Ant Howe. For me, Unitarianism is a form of religion and a philosophy. More than this, it is a pathway, a way of life. There are many ways to be a Unitarian presence in this world and ways to live unitarily. As a Unitarian, I can't just believe whatever I want, but whatever I can and must. My Unitarianism causes me to question my beliefs often, to seek after truth and to be open to new insight, both human and divine. Unitarianism teaches me that revelation is not sealed, that God did not speak just through one book and one person, but that more light and truth can break forth anywhere and at any time where hearts are truly open. In my Unitarian way of being religious, faith and skepticism join hands and coexist quite happily. And when it comes to religion, I can say that something seems to be true to me when it resonates in my heart and in my mind, but I cannot claim to have the monopoly on religious truth. Life, love, God, mystery, and awe, and wonder are all things to be explored rather than labeled and copyrighted. My own Unitarian journey links me with the liberal Christian tradition, where Jesus is my teacher and example. I hear his words, God is one, come echoing down through the centuries. And those commandments that he said were the greatest, that we should love God, love others, love ourselves. Being a Unitarian has helped me to do those things, even learning to love myself, which was the most difficult part. I no longer feel guilty about who I am, and what I can't believe. For the first time in my life, I was able to say, like Jesus, that God and I are one. And this oneness with God and with humanity causes me to seek after justice, to value diversity, and to try and make ethical decisions. I've still got some way to go, even after all these years, but I keep trying. Unitarianism does have its own rich history and theology, but our welcome is wide when it comes to different beliefs. Worship is important to Unitarians. I can worship on my own, and I do, but my life is enriched when I worship with others. Our churches, our chapels, and fellowships are places where beloved community can be found. Where we worship, we socialize, discuss, and just be together. The person sitting next to me might not believe exactly the same as I do. But when I am with other Unitarians, I know that I am with kindred spirits. When I became a Unitarian, I found the thing I didn't even know I was looking for. It was the piece of the jigsaw I didn't even know was missing. It changed my life, and that's why I dedicate myself to sharing it. Don't worry, Unitarians aren't into converting people. I can't promise you a ticket to heaven if you join us, or threaten you with hell if you don't, but I share it because having found such an amazing blessing, it would be selfish just to keep it to myself. Reverend Aunt Howe. Our meditation will be followed by some Bloomsday singing from the choir. Summer is a joyous time. The promise of spring has been fulfilled in the lengthened days and the warmth of the sun. We have much to celebrate in our gatherings. The joining together of familiar friends and new acquaintances, united in recognition of our common humanity. Let us pause in this quietness. Not the silence which is the absence of noise, for there is always noise, rather the peace of a quiet lake, the calm of a child sleeping, the reassurance of a friend listening, the beauty and calm of this, our sacred space. Let us be quiet together.
To fall out of their dreams, their roses. Good morning, everybody, and thanks very much, Gavin, for the introduction and also for facilitating me today. And also thanks to my son Jimbo for flying in to provide moral support. I take it this is my Father's Day present. Unusually, before I commence, I have an announcement to make. As you know, Bridget retired on the 26th of May, but officially in employment terms, she doesn't retire until the 20th of June. Anyway, in our denomination, there's a requirement for the pulpit to be declared vacant. Now, that's normally done by a minister from the presbytery, but it would require someone to travel a couple of hundred miles of a round trip just to make a short announcement. So I've been appointed by the Synod of Munster to make that announcement today, officially, that the pulpit is from the 20th of June will be vacant. Upper Secretary is recording all this. Again, as I said, thanks to Gavin. Gavin mentioned that today is Friday, the 14th of June, was our anniversary in that the church opened for worship on Sunday, the 14th of June in 1863. So it's 161 years old today. The 14th of June, 1702, was also another significant day, and it was the commencement of the trial of Thomas Emlyn, who was on trial for blasphemy for declaring himself to be a Unitarian. So that's 322 years ago on Friday, the Friday gone. Next month is the 180th anniversary of the passing of the Dissenters' Chapels Act that passed on the 15th of July, 1844. And that's the subject that I'm going to address you upon this morning. And I know a few of you are now looking for the exit door, but it was too late. If you saw my name on the advertisement, you would have known it was going to be a history talk. I considered a few titles for this address, including What's in a Name? And Don't Mention the P Word. But I opted for the question, Still a Dissenting Chapel? In March 2020, I received a letter from solicitors acting on behalf of the Presbyterian Church in Ireland. The PCI had recently submitted a legal application for permission to restructure their widow's pension fund, and the Attorney General in Northern Ireland asked the solicitors to write to us in connection with the application. But what did that have to do with us? I'll take you back to a street directory, the Dublin City Directory of 1838. The directory says, there are four Presbyterian congregations in Dublin, Usher's Quay, Mary's Abbey, Strand Street, and Eustace Street. The first two are Trinitarian, and the latter two are Unitarian. There were similar duplications existed in many towns in Southern Ireland. There were differences within and between all the congregations, but they had coexisted and cooperated with each other for almost 200 years. However, upheavals in Presbyterianism in the middle of the 19th century led to the Trinitarian and Unitarian branches eventually going their separate ways. Part of the separation was the legal division of the assets of the Southern Association Widows Fund between the two parties. We got most of it, by the way. This was finalised through the courts in 1849 and appears to have been a fairly civilised affair. So, in 2020, some 170 years later, when the PCI sought permission to restructure their share of the Southern Association Fund, the Attorney General in Northern Ireland thought it would be wise for the PCI to get confirmation that the Unitarians didn't wish to be heard in court in relation to the application. And we didn't, so that passed off fairly smoothly. Other legal proceedings haven't gone so smoothly. As I've said already, and as we frequently say here, there was a famous legal case involving Reverend Thomas Emlyn, a minister in Wood Street around the corner from here, our original congregation, who was jailed in 1702 when he was outed as holding Unitarian views. The defining anti-Trinitarian or Unitarian view, and that is where our Unitarian name comes from, is that there is but one God, and whatever his other qualities, Jesus wasn't divine, and shouldn't be worshipped as a god. And that's why we see in the Wilson window that Jesus is in the center, but in the central panel. And underneath is the label, well, not the label, but it says inspiration. It's the panel for inspiration. So Jesus is seen as a great inspiration, but not as a God. The holding or preaching of such views was deemed blasphemous and illegal, and would remain so up to 1813 in England and 1817 here. The case and its outcome would have great personal consequences for Emlyn, but the case was taken against him alone, and the resulting hardships were suffered by him in isolation and at no real cost to his congregants or fellow ministers. In the following decades, Unitarian views gradually took hold in some of the Dublin congregations. But I have heard it argued that as Unitarianism remained illegal in Ireland until 1817, Unitarians hid themselves inside Presbyterianism. That argument doesn't really stack up. Unitarians weren't hiding. In a piece of doggerel or a rhyme written about Donnybrook Fair, it was called From Donnybrook Fair and a Regular Old, a lengthy rhyme published in 1790. Every occupation and every religion is mentioned as being in attendance at the fair. And there's a line that says, antiquarians, stubborn Arians, and Unitarians. So they were well known in the city long before legality in 1817. If they had been reluctantly hiding behind the Presbyterian label, they would surely have dropped that label after 1817. But they didn't. For decades after 1817, they and others continued to apply Presbyterian to the titles of their ministers, to their meeting houses, to official documentation, and even the collection plates that we use at Christmas have Presbyterian Meeting House, Strand Street on them. Another notorious legal case, the one with which we are concerned this morning, had huge ramifications for the two Unitarian congregations in Dublin, Strand Street and Eustace Street, in that an adverse outcome would have resulted in the loss of all their properties and funds. It proceeded at a time when cases had been taken against sister congregations in Ulster and against Unitarian congregations in England. If you really wish to understand the history of this congregation, you should look up the Eustace Street case, or its official title, The Attorney General versus Hutton. Hutton was the minister in Eustace Street, and he's from the family that are remembered in the window over here. Set plenty of time aside to read the submissions, the arguments, the judgments, plus the reports and the commentary in connection with the legal proceedings. Or, as a favour to you today, you can listen to me giving you a very brief summary. About Eustace Street, in the 19th century, and right up to the Sunday before they moved here, the congregation placed notices for Sunday services in the Irish Times, and they always announced that their services would be held by the Protestant dissenting congregation of Eustace Street. The congregation's meeting house was listed in street directories and shown on maps as a Presbyterian meeting house. The congregation is listed as a founding member of the Association of Non-Subscribers, and the address of the meeting house was the correspondence address for the Irish Unitarian Christian Society. So I hope you're suitably confused at that stage. As Gavin mentioned earlier, it's gone under a lot of names, but some of the names have been employed at the same time. But there's no contradictions. Simply, they were Protestants who dissented from the Church of Ireland. They had a Presbyterian form of governance. They were non-subscribers as they refused to impose a subscription to any creed. And they held a Unitarian theological outlook. The Eustace Street congregation was deemed to be said to be the wealthiest Presbyterian congregation in Ireland. It was many members of the new emerging commercial class were members of Eustace Street. They had significant funds, schools, a widow's almshouse, and they made financial provision for ministers' widows. Much of the money had been bequeathed in 1718 and 1710 and 1718 by Joseph Damer and Arthur Langford, and the funds were supplemented by several later bequests. Also, it had access to an older general fund for the support of Protestant dissenters. The general fund was administered by trustees from a group of Presbyterian congregations, both Unitarian and Trinitarian, and it operated for over 130 years without disturbance. However, there was trouble on the horizon. Across the water, or on the mainland, as Gavin likes to refer to it as, Lady Ewley had left a substantial legacy for the protection and promotion of Protestant dissent. By the end of the 18th century, all the trustees and a majority of the Presbyterian recipients were Unitarian. Independents from Manchester objected to this controlling influence, and in 1830, they brought a lawsuit concerned with the enforcement of the terms of Lady Hewley's will. One of the topics in contention was the funding of the Manchester Academy. The initial legal ruling sustained the view that a Trinitarian commitment was necessary from those with benefits from the endowments. This judgment was twice appealed, but was upheld by the Lord Chancellor in 1836 and again by the House of Lords in 1842. As a result, the Unitarian trustees of the fund were removed, and in their place, three Congregationalists, three Orthodox Presbyterians, and one Baptist were appointed as the trustees of the fund. A similar situation arose here in Ireland. As I said, Joseph Damer and others had bequeathed funds to Christians for the promotion of Protestant dissent in the previous century. This fund had come to the attention of a George Matthews, who had recently joined Fermoy Presbyterian Church. He applied to be a trustee of the general fund and sought a grant for Fermoy. The application was refused by the general fund. George Matthews of Fermoy was actually Duncan Chisholm of Inverness, Scotland, a former solicitor and trader and a fugitive from justice in Scotland, where there was a reward of 50 guineas for evidence that would lead to his apprehension and prosecution. Bankrupt and leaving debts and an impoverished wife behind him, he made his way to Dublin. He secured a position as a low-ranking clerk in Dublin Castle, from where he worked his way up to become a person of great influence. Through his access to documents held in the castle, he became aware of the funds belonging to the Dublin churches and opportunistically joined Fermoy to take advantage of the legal suits then in train against Unitarians. Following the refusal of his application for a grant for Fermoy, he filed a lawsuit with the Irish Court of Chancery in 1840 for a breach of trust that became the Attorney General versus Drummond. And Drummond is the man whose portrait, the large portrait that's down in our vestry. A further lawsuit was filed against the trustees of the Eustace Street congregation, and a suit was in the offing against Strand Street. The first case was heard by Lord Chancellor Sir Edward Sugden. And the opening submission of the plaintiffs was, the information stated that the said congregations of Strand Street and Eustace Street, lately abandoning their ancient faith, had adopted the opinions which are commonly called Unitarian, and that the Reverend Joseph Hutton and Reverend Dr. Ledley, Minister of Eustace Street, and Dr. Drummond, Minister of Strand Street, respectively taught and preached Unitarian doctrines, and that the lay elders and members of the said congregations belonged to the sect of Unitarians, but that the ministers, elders and congregations of Mary's Abbey and Usher's Quay still maintained their faith, being Trinitarian Presbyterians. Note of interest, the Mary's Abbey that's referred to in that the previous words, later built a church on Parnell Square, and it's commonly known as Findlater's Church, and I'm sure it's very familiar to you all. Usher's Quay moved a few times, and I think they're now in Clontarf. Neither of these congregations were party to the case against the Unitarians. It was further submitted that, according to the true construction of the trust deed, it was inconsistent with the trusts to apply any portion of it to the teachers of doctrines at variance with belief in the Trinity as held by the five Protestant dissenting congregations at the time of the execution of the deed. The time of the execution of the deed was 1710. Of the five congregations referred to, the three, Wood Street, Cook Street and New Row, were non-subscribing and were religiously liberal. By 1767, these three had evolved into Strand Street and Eustace Street, and in 1867, the two of them finally amalgamated here in St. Stephen's Green. The plaintiffs leaned heavily into the Emlyn trial of 1702, pointing out that when Emlyn was jailed for his Unitarian beliefs, his beliefs were refuted by his fellow dissenting ministers. The defence then is just part of it. These things run very long, but I'll just summarise it for you. This is an extract. Evidence cannot be received to restrict or cut down the signification of the words Protestant dissenter in this deed. Now, Unitarians, beyond all question, are Protestant dissenters, and they are so to a peculiar degree, for the imposition of creeds is a mode of popery. The defendants are Christian, are Protestants, are dissenters, and these are the only characteristics which the word of the deed require. This court has no right to qualify these words by adding the requisite of a belief in the Trinity. So, in summary, the plaintiffs submitted that the Unitarians are not Protestant dissenters and are probably not Christian at all, and that the funds were donated by people who were Trinitarians for Trinitarians. The defendants argued that the donors were members of congregations that had always been non-subscribing Protestant dissenters, whose distinguishing principles have ever been the rejection of human creeds, articles, and confessions. They added, Unitarians most definitely are Christians, and most definitely are Protestant dissenters, and indeed are the most dissenting Protestants of all. The Lord Chancellor had a lot of evidence to consider, and his judgment ran to 35 pages. When he returned, he said, the question he had to ask himself is, who are the Christians, who are Christians, who are Protestant dissenters? The court must put two different constructions on similar instruments, one being the foundation of Unitarian, who, when he speaks of Christianity, means Unitarian Christianity, and when he speaks of Protestant dissenters, means what I am told are the best of all Protestant dissenters, Unitarians. The Lord Chancellor had a very difficult task. I was trying to find something comparable today, but could you imagine if someone 130 years ago had left a fund for the promotion of socialism? Can you imagine the fund there would be in the High Court as the different parties battle out over who were the correct socialists? Anyway, the judge also made references to Emlyn, and he said, Emlyn's own account of his trial and how he was left on his own. The events of 1702 had come back to haunt the Unitarians. The Lord Chancellor found against the Unitarians, but in my opinion, reading through the judgment, he acted fairly. He complimented the Unitarian representatives for their evidence and eloquence of their arguments. He commented on his own judgment. It may be necessary and legal to do so, but it is not very just. The outcome was devastating for the two Dublin congregations. Because of existing law, even the funds subsequently donated by avowed Unitarians would be lost. It meant that all assets, the meeting houses, congregational funds, the schools, the widow's house, and the pension funds would go out of Unitarian ownership. However, impending events in Parliament led Lord Sugden to defer his final decision until the next law term. As a direct consequence of the legal ruling in the Hewley case in England, a group was pressing for legislation to halt the expected flood of litigation against Unitarians. A campaign commenced in support of this legislation here in Dublin, and lobbying and fundraising was undertaken in the city, and the Reverend George Armstrong, the man who's remembered in the memorial just behind where Gavin is sitting, our first minister here in Stephen's Green, was dispatched to London to represent the interests of our congregations to the legislators. The campaign was a success and resulted in the passing of the Dissenters' Chapels Act. And in the Act, a figure of 25 years was established, after which the right of possession of a chapel could not be challenged on doctrinal grounds. Baron Cottenham added a clause to protect the two chapels in Dublin over which litigation was currently active. Despite extensive opposition from religious groups, the bill passed through Parliament on the 15th of July, 1844. The Bible Christian, which was a Unitarian publication, reported on the passing of the bill. This bill, which we may call our Bill of Rights, has at length obtained the royal assent. We mean to publish it at length in our next number, so that our readers may preserve a document so interesting to our denomination and so important in the history of religious liberty. We are glad to observe that at the last meeting of non-subscribing Presbyterians held in Dublin, it was resolved in connection with this subject that Sunday, August the 25th, be observed as a day of special thanksgiving. And we trust that the occasion will be used to enforce the great principles of truth, freedom, and charity. Let us hope that the discord and strife which unjust aggressions on our religious property engendered shall now cease, and that the efforts of our church shall be zealously directed to the promotion of pure and undefiled religion. So that settled the matter. But there were occasional ripples after that. You can see from the documentation when Eustace Street amalgamated with Strand Street here in Stephen's Green, that they took legal advice as to whether they were covered under the Acts. Also in 1910, when the various groups of non-subscribers founded the non-subscribing Presbyterian Church of Ireland, the Synod of Munster, to which we belong, didn't join. At that time, the Privy Councillor, it's hard to imagine this now, the Privy Councillor, the Master of the Rolls, and the future Lord Chief Justice of Northern Ireland were all members of the Managing Committee in this church. The Privy Councillor was actually the chairman. They were all from Northern Ireland originally, or what is now Northern Ireland, and they were all from non-subscribing families. But they advised Reverend Savile Hicks that the constitution of the newly formed NSPCI could leave the Southern churches open to further claims against the property and funds. This was overcome in 1935 when a freedom of conscience clause was inserted into this Synod of Munster, or inserted into the NSPCI constitution, and the Synod of Munster was then cleared to join the NSPCI. What relevance does any of this have 180 years on? Our refusal to have creeds imposed upon us or to impose them on others provides us with an intellectual freedom that has allowed us to seek knowledge and inspiration from sources beyond our Christian roots. However, it appears to me as though in order to learn some new things, we have to forget or even deny some old things. So I often hear some very strange notions or descriptions of what Unitarianism is. Quite often heard them before, occasionally I've heard them before weddings or people coming in and arranging their marriages. And one of the couple might say, well, I'm a Protestant and she's a Catholic, and we thought we'd get married here in this multi-faith church. I have to say my eyebrows arch a little. You have to say it's a bit of a raw deal for the Catholics. I know when they come into the church, there's on the way in, there's no holy water font, no confession boxes, no stations of the cross, no altar, no tabernacle, and there's the absence of any features you'd expect to find in a Catholic church. What they will find, though, which you won't find in a Catholic church, is a female celebrant. And if they do say the Lord's Prayer during the service, it's the Protestant version. Until the recent marriage changes to marriage laws, the state changes, the couple would have signed a marriage register. I think this is up to about 2010, in which it said that they were married in accordance with the rites and customs of the Presbyterian Church. And it all happens under the watchful eye of Martin Luther. Possibly if they had checked the Catholic Encyclopedia, they would have seen that the Unitarians are described as a liberal Protestant sect which holds as distinctive its distinctive tenet the belief in a unipersonal instead of a tripersonal God. Our freedom-loving, creedless congregation only enjoys this beautiful building because our Unitarian ancestors were prepared to vigorously defend our freedoms in the Court of Chancery and in the corridors of power in London. What if someone antagonistic to Unitarianism took a case similar to that taken by George Matthews? What if they took it against us nowadays? We still operate and benefit from funds bequeathed to Protestant dissenters. What if our right to the ownership of these funds was challenged? Would we accept the claims that we are not Christian and not Protestant dissenters and meekly hand over the funds? Or, like the people who built this church, would we strenuously assert that Unitarians most definitely are Christians, most definitely are Protestant dissenters, and indeed are the most dissenting Protestants of all? Amen.
Thank you, Rory. Now, our third hymn is number 12, O Life That Maketh All Things New, and after which we'll have the collection. Our notices. Just to say thank you to all who work behind the scenes to get the church ready for our celebration, both Wednesday and on Sunday. Thank you. With our pulpit empty of a minister, well, apparently not for another few days, we still have you, Bridget, we are looking for members of the congregation to lead our services. You may be happy to lead the whole service or just wish to give the address. So please think about it and speak to me if you would like to volunteer. Saturday, the 29th of June, is a tale of two walks. The Unitarian Walkers, led by Marcus, will take on the Wicklow Devil's Glen, and they're meeting at Ashford at 11 a.m. And if you'd like to join them, please see Marcus, and you can be added to their WhatsApp group. That's Marcus over there. The other walk doesn't involve any devils at all. Rather, it will be angels marching in the Pride Parade from O'Connell Street to Merrion Square. We will meet at 11:30 a.m. around the spire in O'Connell Street. I'll be able to tell you exactly where. But if you'd like to join us, I've got wristbands today. Please talk to me downstairs. This month's Uscult is there. Please take a copy. And after the service, please join us downstairs, particularly if you're new, if this is your first time, for tea and coffee. Now, I mentioned at the beginning that we have another cause for a celebration in our community this week. And with her permission, I'm able to announce that on Thursday, our friend Catherine Cook will become an Irish citizen at a ceremony in Dublin. And Rory, a citizen of this most beautiful mainland. We are so happy for you, Catherine. Well, welcome. So let's take our final hymn, which is number 66, When the Summer Sun is Shining. Our closing prayer is for peace. The history is complex, the politics are intense. The fear and anger are overwhelming, and the future is unclear. But glimpses of a hopeful vision will not be bombed into oblivion by anyone. In prayer, we call to mind the peacemakers,
neighbours of differing faiths, with different histories, with different politics, with different emotions. We find room for each other in our hearts, in our dreams, and in our lives. Those who hold firmly to a vision of peace and justice anywhere in the world, but especially today in Ukraine, in Palestine, in Israel, and wherever there is conflict. Spirit of life and love, be present with all who are suffering terribly from violence. Lift up the hearts of those who fear and inspire courage among the peacemakers. Be present with political leaders, ensuring a retreat from violence and a procession towards the peace table. Guide the hands of all who are caring for the injured, the hungry, and the grieving. And open our hearts to compassion and empathy. Remind us of our complicity and our responsibility. And lead us towards generous engagement and move us always towards a vision of peace. Amen.